A muscular Asian alliance was on full display this week. So is the Democrats' most successful strategy so far for frustrating President Donald Trump. And we also got a closer look at Mr. Trump's peace plans for Gaza. We're going to talk about all this and more on today's Trumpet World. All the way back in 1934, in one of the very first issues of his Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong described two great military powers that he said would arise in the last days, one the revival of the Roman Empire by a federation of 10 nations in the territory of the ancient Roman Empire. The other, he said, would be Russia with her allies, and these would be possibly China or Japan. Now, the decades after that forecast didn't really look very good for that forecast. After World War II, China became communist, but then the two communist powers quickly fell out. But Mr. Armstrong stood behind that forecast, and in 1959, when tensions between Russia and China were high, the Plain Truth had this to say. Russia's program calls first for the seizure of Asia. And it said that China would voluntarily submit to Russian leadership in an Asian bloc as a step towards achieving their long-term goals. China's constant dream for centuries has been ultimate world conquest, it stated. China knows, however, in this highly industrialized age, she can accomplish this dream only as an ally of Russia. And then it said, China is now ready to begin devouring the rest of Asia with Russia's secret military backing. These are just some of the statements where Herbert W. Armstrong and the magazine that he led forecast this alliance of Russia and China based on Bible prophecy, and indeed a wider Asian alliance with other important Asian nations a part of that. And this week, we had that alliance, and really that fulfilled prophecy, you could say, on full, vibrant display. And so to tell us more about that, we'll hear from our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. It was really just a momentous week for being able to watch this Asian alliance just drawing rapidly closer, becoming much tighter. I think probably the most notable aspect of this was China holding the largest military parade in its history, just showcasing a very menacing array of world-class weaponry. And they were not at all alone in this parade. The Chinese invited the leaders of several nations that they're partnered with to attend. And among these were Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un, and, you know, more than a dozen others as well. But both of these men being there made this, I think, just have an especially grim tone, really, to the whole event. You could call this the axis of upheaval, these three there. And they were all just watching as this sweeping range of armory was rolled out. And it truly was an extensive range. China took the opportunity here to showcase its full nuclear triad. So that's strategic land, sea, and air-based systems that can fire nuclear weapons. And we also got a close look at the Dongfeng 5C nuclear missile itself, an extremely powerful weapon. Several of those were on display in the parade. They also showcased the AJX-002 underwater drone as well, and some new laser weapons. Altogether, there were hundreds of units of military equipment and aircraft that took part in the parade. And it is true that pretty much all of this weaponry originated from technology that was stolen from the United States. You know, the Chinese have been conducting an operation for decades now to steal U.S. military tech and then reverse engineer it and mass produce it. But that doesn't mean that these arsenals are not formidable. The Chinese have come a long way over the last decade, especially, and the quality of their weaponry is far higher, and the lethality of these systems is extremely significant. And of course, they also have the numbers of men to go along with it. The parade featured about 10,000 troops from China's army of 2.2 million. But I think that just as significant as all of that weaponry and all those soldiers was the fact that Vladimir Putin was right there, shoulder to shoulder with Xi Jinping. as they oversaw this stunning array of weaponry rolling through Beijing. So these two men, of course, they declared a few years ago that there are no limits to their partnership. And they have shown in the time since that they really have each other's backs in war. You know, China has been a huge part of the reason why Russia still has weaponry and why Russia still has money to pay its troops, even 3.5 years into its war on Ukraine. So these two men and their vast nations are deeply aligned, and they're aligned to dismantle the U.S.-led global order, the U.S.-led order that has brought a lot of peace and a lot of opportunity to billions of people over the last several decades. Russia and China are doing everything that they can to dismantle that. So it is sobering to see them, along with more than a dozen other nations represented there, just to see them all assembled in Beijing, watching this parade, showing the world that they stand in defiance of the current order, and that they stand very much in unity with each other. And to see these nations, Russia and China in particular, drawing militarily closer, this is something that the trumpet carefully watches, because Bible prophecy told us to expect this, as you said a moment ago. We have an in-depth article that's called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, and it takes a careful look at passages in the biblical books of Ezekiel and Daniel, Matthew and Revelation, and others. And these passages together show that Russia and China will soon be allied completely together, along with other Asian nations, and they will join their forces to create the largest army by far that the world has ever witnessed, bigger by orders of magnitude than any army that's ever been created. And these passages also show that this Asian alliance will play a major role in World War III. And this is something, as you said a moment ago, that Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong warned about for years, dating all the way back to the 1930s, close to 100 years ago. And even back in the 50s and 60s, when Russia and China were at each other's throats, they hated each other and they were engaged in a serious border war, fighting against each other. Even then, Mr. Armstrong repeatedly said, don't be fooled by the current tension, or at least don't make the mistake of thinking that these tensions between Russia and China will last. They won't last. The scriptures show that they will soon be joining their forces together. You know, he maintained that forecast even during those very rocky times between Russia and China. And sure enough, as the years went by, they buried the hatchet, they made peace with each other, and now we see that they are stunningly close. So it shows that Mr. Armstrong was exactly right. And that article that I mentioned goes through all those various Bible passages, and it also goes through a lot of what Mr. Armstrong wrote and warned about over the years, and it holds up alongside current events such as this big military parade that we saw this week, also the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit that we saw this week as well. So I think that this article right now would be a very powerful read in light of current events. So for anyone who would like to understand all of these developments in the prophetic context, once again, that article is called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China.
And Russia and China are two of the biggest members of this prophesied alliance. They're also not the only members. And we saw other news this week that points to the other members of this Asian alliance coming on board. I mean, you mentioned Kim Jong-un and North Korea there with these trio of dictators. In many ways, the outlier of this alliance, or the one that has not quite been on the same page, certainly with China, has been India. And again, you know, we forecast their role in this Asian alliance. India and China, I mean, even fairly recently, have been trading blows. We saw that relationship take a major step forward this week as well, didn't we?
That's right. Extremely notable to see India and its leader meeting inside of China this week with Xi Jinping. So India's leader, Narendra Modi, he did not attend China's big military parade in Beijing, but he did attend that Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting that also happened a little bit earlier in the week inside of China. So, yeah, just a huge week for evidence of Asian cooperation and of these, to see these nations drawing closer. And Prime Minister Modi's meeting there, his trip, you know, to visit inside of China actually marks the first time that he's traveled there in 7 years. And as you said, that's because there has been very profound tension between China and India. That's over a territorial dispute between the two of them. And that territorial dispute turned bloody back in 2020 and left China and India very hostile toward each other. They actually had several years during which their diplomatic ties were totally disintegrated. And that was to the advantage of the United States. You know, India, after all, is a democracy. It's the world's largest democracy. And it has been a valuable partner for the United States for many years. So it was to America's advantage to have India drawing nearer to us as it was pulling away from China. But now everything is changing. Now the United States and India are the ones with the deeply strained relations. That's largely over America's 50% tariff that's placed on Indian goods. And now Modi is patching things up with the Chinese. So he actually traveled to China for this SCO summit, and he personally met with Xi Jinping, and they are mending fences very quickly. The pictures from this meeting are really remarkable. If you see these images of Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi, they have their heads thrown back in laughter. They're clutching each other's hands very warmly. It's the sort of thing that would have been unheard of to see anything remotely like this, even just a few months ago. So it really shows how quickly they're burying the hatchet there. India right now is also drawing much closer to Russia in light of the strained relations between India and the U.S. And all of this alignment between India with China and Russia, that is something that the trumpet has been expecting. We've been anticipating that based on biblical prophecy as well. So it's very sobering, I think, to see it all happening right now.
And are there any other stories from Asia worth paying close attention to from this week?
I just wanted to mention one final story about the peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine. Those efforts are not going very well, despite the big summit in Alaska with President Trump and President Putin a few weeks back there. It seems that Putin really just took that as license to ramp up his attacks on Ukraine, in particular his attacks on civilians many miles away from the front lines. So we've seen almost nightly aerial bombardments from Russia on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure and residences. And Ukraine, in turn, is attacking more of Russia's oil refining facilities, trying to hit just the, you know, the lifeblood of Russia's economy so that Russia can't fund the war anymore. And then yesterday, Vladimir Putin, after having declined to meet with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky for months, yesterday, Putin said Zelensky should travel to Moscow to meet with him and talk about ceasefire options. Now, this is a ludicrous offer, really. It's well established that Putin tried to have Zelensky assassinated several times, especially early in the war, just in an effort to decapitate Ukraine and to hopefully install kind of a puppet government that would be loyal to Russia. So I think Zelensky, it would be suicidal for him to travel to Moscow right now to meet with Putin. But nevertheless, this move, I think that it allows Putin a chance to say to President Trump and to others, hey, I'm trying to make peace. I made an offer. The other guy is the one who's not obliging. So it's really just more evidence, I think, of how remote reaching peace in this terrible war still seems to be.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Lawfare is a major theme of the news from the United States this week. The Atlantic magazine celebrated lawsuits, lawsuits, and more lawsuits as the anti-Trump strategy that's actually working. President Trump had several court cases go against him. To hear about those and about this strategy, we'll go to our U.S. correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the level of lawfare being waged against President Donald Trump is really unprecedented. We actually wrote this up earlier in the year about just that the number of nationwide injunctions against Trump administration actions is actually more than like the number of injunctions against all other presidents going back to Reagan. The Supreme Court even weighed in on that and said that district courts can't even issue national injunctions or aren't supposed to be issuing national injunctions anymore because their jurisdiction's is restricted to their district. And not a nationwide thing. But that Supreme Court case definitely hasn't stopped the lawfare. There's many, many other tools courts can use to try to undermine the Trump administration. I think one of the most shocking cases we had in a Trumpet brief this week, Lilliputian Courts versus Donald Trump, was regarding the Trump administration's standoff against Harvard University, where ever since the October 7th, Hamas attacks on Israel, and even before, Harvard's really become a hotbed of anti-Semitic activity, people calling for death to the Jews, people protesting against Israel. So the Trump administration has threatened to cut off their funding, which I think it's about, $2 billion a year. And the courts came out and ruled that, like, well, due to free speech concerns, he can't do that. And the legal issues over exactly what is and isn't free speech are more complicated, but this is definitely very clear cut that even if Harvard has a right to say those horrible things, they don't have a right to be paid for it. The U.S. federal government does not have to give Harvard University money. And if the Trump administration rules that, like, okay, well, you're making anti-Semitic comments and the U.S. government does not want to be sending taxpayer dollars to you to support that, he might not be able to step in and say, you're not allowed to say that anymore, but he's definitely allowed to step in and say, I'm not sending you money anymore. And so huge miscarriage of justice in this case. And it's not the only one. We have a number of other ones we highlighted in that Trumpet brief. There's the one, this one I have a little more sympathy for, where they issued a temporary restraining order saying that President Trump can't fire the Federal Reserve Board Chair, Governor Lisa Cook, because he had invoked a law saying that, well, because she committed mortgage fraud, I have right to remove her. I don't think she's been committed of mortgage fraud. So in that case, that the court might have a point there. It's another example of the courts undermining the Trump administration, but definitely not the huge miscarriage of justice that we heard about in the first one with Harvard. But there's another one as well where the Trump administration, like Joe Biden, had given temporary asylum to some Venezuelan refugees, and then Trump revoked the temporary asylum. And then the courts ruled, well, you can't do that. And that's another one, again, we're like, okay, well, the original temporary asylum was done by presidential decree. So anything done by presidential decree can be undone by presidential decree. It's not like you're trying to overturn an act of Congress or something like that, or violation of the separation of powers. The previous president had said, oh, don't deport those people. And then the new president said, do deport those people. So if the new president's decree is unconstitutional, then the first president's decree was unconstitutional.
Right. It's like when you look at it in the big picture, some of the smaller ones, some of those cases, yeah, maybe it is President Trump in the wrong. And perhaps part of this is that President Trump is pushing the envelope in terms of what a president can accomplish. He's trying to get a lot done. I mean, I'm kind of working on an article at the moment that just talks about the way that President Trump is accomplishing a lot, and Europe with all of their squabbling leaders isn't getting much done at the moment, and they're getting a vivid look at just what a strong man can do. And you know, you do a lot, you are going to generate more court cases. But you step back and look at the bigger picture, there is a broad-based effort just to bring down President Trump or bring down, stop him from accomplishing anything through lawsuits, many of which aren't in good faith. I mean, this Atlantic article that I mentioned, 384 court cases they highlighted that had been filed since the start of the year up until August 28th, 130 of them blocking at least part of his efforts, 148 awaiting a ruling. That broader picture, okay, we could talk about or we could kind of argue maybe one or two cases, but the broader picture of hundreds of cases against him shows that you've got the judiciary really out of control in many ways. And you know, you had Amy Coney Barrett this week having an article for the Free Press where she made a great point. She said, we judges don't dispense justice solely as we see it. Instead, we are constrained by law adopted through the democratic process. She said, judges are referees, not kings, because they decide whether people have played by the rules rather than what the rules should be. And judges stepping out of this role is something that Mr. Flurry, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, has warned about for years. And here, this is a clip from a Key of David that he gave, or several clips we've kind of put together, from a Key of David he gave on the rule of law and the threat that these judges pose to the rule of law all the way back in 2009.
And in verse 11, the heads thereof judge for reward, and the priests thereof teach for hire, and the prophets thereof divine for money. Yet will they lean upon the Lord and say, well, is not the Lord among us? None evil can come upon us. God says, you better rethink that. You better rethink that. You're not living the way you should. You better rethink it. But do really look, and when you realize that like the Supreme Court justices are chosen for life, and the only ruler they have is the Constitution. If they don't believe in the Constitution, they just don't have any rule, and they have a lot of power, and they can become a kind of a tyrant. That's how serious this is, and it's similar with other judges. Well, they judge for a reward. Look at Micah 6 and verse 8. It talks about to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly before God. That's all God expects of us. But the first principle there is to do justly. That's the key priority here. Do you do justly? Do you judge your own family, or do you judge in the job you have the way God judges? With His love, His mercy, His humility. You see, our Constitution won't work without that understanding and without that character. And when we lose the Constitution and we lose the law of God, we are going to lose everything. That is something for each one of us to think about very, very carefully.
So he concluded that Key of David saying, well, we risk losing everything because judges are not being governed by the law. They're just judging according to their own personal opinions, what they think should happen in this case or that case, and often just making up the law to go along with that. So, you know, if we kind of step back and we often talk about President Trump and God had a role in bringing President Trump into office and preserving his life, we remember vividly, you know, the way where he came millimeters away from death. One of the reasons God said he did that is to save Israel from bitter affliction, to save America from bitter affliction. That's something Mr. Flurry talks about in America Under Attack. And that's primarily bitter affliction through one man, through Barack Obama. You know, you have to see there's a spiritual warfare behind U.S. politics. There's a spiritual dimension going on there. And Satan the devil was using that one man. And so President Trump was saving America from bitter affliction there. But part of that bitter affliction is almost the judicial tyranny that President Obama played a leading role in getting set up. And we see that fight in a way still ongoing.
Yeah, and it's been something that's been developing for years. This problem is way, way, way more prevalent amongst the Democrats, the people who follow the theory they call the living Constitution, that the Constitution is something that evolves and something that's changing. And so you definitely see here a spirit of judges that are coming in and you're like, well, I want to like uphold my political party no matter what. We've got an article we can put in the show notes titled America's Broken Judgment that goes through Micah 3 where it says, a hero heads of Jacob and you princes of your house are Israel. Is it not for you to know judgment? And then the rest of the chapter talks about these just corrupt judges that are, it almost like it's some of the most graphic language in the Bible, liking them to like cannibals that kill people and rip the flesh off their bones and eat it. And it's all this allegory of just like how corrupt and selfish and bloodthirsty these courts are in end time America. And then we also have another one in Amos 7 about the kingdom's court, which our editor-in-chief drew attention to in his article, Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy? And it's about an end-time leader in Israel, an antitype of Jeroboam II, who the article makes the case that this is Donald Trump, who's supported by a kingdom's court, or this would be the court for the, not for the district, not a district court, but a court for like the whole nation, or the Supreme Court, that's actually helping, favoring the Jeroboam administration, or helping him support the law. And so we do see that, and time after time, it is actually, increasingly, it is the Supreme Court, they can't rule on every case, but it is the Supreme Court that's trying to involve and bring some of these lower courts to heel and allow Donald Trump to get at least some stuff done. I feel like if it wasn't for the Supreme Court, these lower courts would have just completely hobbled the Trump administration and it'd be like a lame duck who never accomplished anything. But because of the Supreme Court, he is getting some, he is able to use his executive power to get some stuff done, like that Amos prophecy is talking about. But the Micah 1 prophecy is still there, and definitely the Trump administration has been a lot less effective than it could be, because when he tries to say that, well, I'm revoking that order Joe Biden made saying Venezuelan immigrants can stay here, and then the courts go back, it's like, oh no, that executive order Joe Biden's auto pen made is now basically a constitutional amendment and cannot be undone.
So a significant prophecy that we are in the midst of watching unfold, and an important forecast there of watch for how the Supreme Court gets involved in this and how President Trump does get control of the government. What other stories did you have for us from the English-speaking world this week?
Yeah, a couple other English-speaking stories here. One that's more of a societal trend, talking about just how bad assisted suicide is getting in Canada. This is something that back in 2016, so that's about 9 years ago, Canada ruled that people who wanted to commit suicide, instead of doing it themselves, could actually have a medical doctor help with it. And it's really taken off since then. I think in those 9 years, about 60,000 people have died that way. New report saying that in 2023, which is 2 years ago, but the most recent year we have statistics for, like 15,543 people died that way, meaning that this is now about 1 in 20 deaths in Canada are by assisted suicide, which is a record high, and I think close to being like the 1 in 20, that's close to being like the leading cause of death in Canada. So really horrible story. Yeah, actually, yeah, it is the leading cause of death in Canada. So 1 in 20. So it's like of people who die in Canada, the most common thing you die of is assisted suicide. Then in the U.S., we have some more news where we talked about the courts trying to undermine the tariffs. But they're not able to stop them completely because tariff revenue topped $31 billion in August. That's a new record high for the United States, and is actually set, if the courts don't hold it back too much, to generate $500 billion in revenue this year. So something that's definitely reducing America's trade with the rest of the world, and leading the rest of the world to develop alternative trade blocks, fulfilling a prophecy in Isaiah 23 about a mart of nations that forms around the United States that trades with each other but not with the U.S. But again, and on the positive side also, I've definitely criticized the Trump administration before for making some very drastic income tax cuts that's really making America's national debt problem much worse. So now that you've got potentially $500 billion in tariff revenue, that tariff income is going to be offsetting the income tax reductions, at least somewhat.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Now, news in the Middle East this week was driven by competing visions for what the Holy Land should look like after the war in Gaza is done. President Trump actually seems serious about his Trump-Gaza plan. European nations plus the UK, Canada, and Australia want an independent Palestinian state, and Israel is taking steps to make sure that doesn't happen. To tell us more about this, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
The Washington Post leaked a report on August 30th of, as you said, President Trump's plan for Gaza, and that has been circulating through multiple departments and apparently for some time, that suggests the announcement he made back in February that America is going to take care of Gaza, we're going to own it, quote unquote, was not just more usual bluster and bait for his critics, but actual government policy. The details of this report: the United States would govern Gaza for at least 10 years through the Gaza Reconstruction, Economic Acceleration and Transformation, or Great Trust. This would be an expansion of the work currently done by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Technically, GHF doesn't have a part to do this, but according to the report, they're to voluntarily dissolve once Great gets on the road. So whatever's going on there, which we've talked to previously, it looks like that's a precursor for this. Gazans who leave, we've talked about relocation, Gazan people voluntarily going to other countries before, they would get $5,000, 4 years of rent, and a year of food. There's an estimated billions in revenue, both in public financing and private investment to get this going. They didn't specify exactly what these networks are, but it sounds like they have some things already at least being prepared. This plan to implement Gaza into a new economic zone, which will have free trade both with Europe and the Gulf Arab states. And there's already some mega projects planned out for what this new Gaza looks like, including, and I quote, the Gaza Trump Riviera, meant sort of as a Dubai-style resort complex on the Mediterranean Sea, as well as the Elon Musk Smart Manufacturing Zone, the MBS Ring, which is the acronyms of the leader of Saudi Arabia, and the MBZ Central Highway, which is the acronyms of the leaders of the United Arab Emirates. If these two leaders are actually involved in these plans and given their input, they're not going to say, but either way, the U.S. government plans on getting them involved somehow.
Yeah, I think it shows these are, at the very least, their ambitions. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're things they'd like these different individuals, from Elon Musk to MBS to finance, or so, you know, they're hoping to get these guys involved at the very least, if they're not already agreed to be involved.
Well, even if you look at the Washington Post made the report, you click public, you click it and scroll through it, and you see even logos of companies like IKEA listed on who's going to help build things up. I don't know if that was done with their knowledge, but it's curious to think of maybe.
And just to clarify, are they saying that they would get the buildings from IKEA, or that IKEA would bring jobs to the area?
I think more that they would help. It's a bit ambiguous, but I think it's more a little bit of both. And according to the calculations of whoever compiled the report, by year 10, this new America-controlled Gaza is expected to have an annual revenue of over $4.5 billion. And there are a lot of different statistics that they throw up on what private investment is going to like, et cetera, that either way, it shows that the U.S. has given some very serious thought into the details and all the different mechanisms that are going to go into this.
So, I mean, what do you make of this in light of Bible prophecy? I think when it first came out, you know, it came out with the AI video, and I don't think we took it that seriously. It kind of felt like we weren't sure that Donald Trump was taking it that seriously. Now, you know, maybe he is a bit more serious about it. Where do you see this going?
Assuming he is serious and he has the means to actually implement it, which is a whole other question, there are a couple of paths that this could take. We've spoken leading up to last year's election about how 2 Kings 14 speaks of Jeroboam, a prophetic office we associate with President Trump coming in to bring relief, respite to the nations of Israel, including recovering something for Judah. That's verse 28. Sometimes the news that has been coming out of Washington has flip-flopped back and forth with whether he's actually helping the Jewish state with their terror war and security situation or whether he's actually hurting them. The ceasefire deal with that President Trump pressured in the winter is an example of that. But if he comes in and actively helps uproot Hamas and implements a new governing authority in Gaza and gives Israel American finance backing, American protection of the UN, etc., that could come a long way, at least in the short term, of perhaps filling in what 2 Kings 14 indicates. In the long term, we expect Gaza specifically and the Palestinians that live there to fall under an alliance we call the Psalm 83 Alliance, which we discuss often on this program. You could look at Psalm 83 and discusses a group of Middle Eastern nations that, whether you look in the Bible, whether you look in secular history, have never actually come together. And they certainly have never come together for what it says in verse 4, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. This has led Trump editor-in-chief Mr. Gerald Fleury to label this a prophecy for now. And it mentions the Philistines, who inhabited Gaza. It was even called that back in biblical times. It mentions the Ishmaelites, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Gulf Arabs, and it mentions Germany or Asher, Assyria. And our trends article on that, why the Trumpet watches an alliance between Germany and Arab nations, can fill in a bit more on those details. But the point is, at this point, Gaza was this terrorist state that was sponsored by Iran, that was against the West, that was against Europe, that was against the modern Arab countries, and that Bible prophecy elsewhere shows is going to be against Germany and its allies. That article goes in through more details. So while Hamas was governing Gaza, we were expecting it's not going to stay in the Iranian camp for long. It's going to have some sort of a switch. At this point, Hamas is still in Gaza. It doesn't have much control, but it is still in Gaza. But something has to replace it. What is going to replace it? If the president gets his way, it could be a lot of money from the Emiratis, from the Saudis, from the Ishmaelites. It could have a free trade agreement with Europe. You could see the European Union and Germany getting involved that way. It's until these action points in the report are put on the ground, it is a bunch of what ifs.
So let's bring the West Bank, or Judea and Samaria, is probably even a more accurate term for that region, into the discussion. You have had, over the last few weeks, we've been covering nation after nation, led by France, and then with Britain, Canada, Australia, Belgium, you know, others, pledging to recognize this month a independent Palestinian state. And that automatically puts the focus on the West Bank. Because if you're going to have an independent Palestinian state, that's where the bulk of the territory is going to be. Gaza is under, you know, is a war zone right now. And these European countries and, you know, Canada, Britain, they would very much like to see that be the outcome of this war, that there's some kind of settlement, peace settlement, where you get an independent Palestinian state. Israel has responded by kind of working on the facts on the ground, setting up new settlements and trying to make sure that Jerusalem is at the very least salvaged from such a Palestinian state, and that there's some of the Israeli settlements around Jerusalem are kind of firmly bolted on to Israeli territory. What do you make of this and where this is leading?
Well, this ties into my second story. On August 31st, Axios reported Israel is seriously considering annexing Area C of the West Bank, which is, per the Oslo Accords, the area that Israel is allowed to build settlements and that has both military and civil control and is over half of the West Bank or Judea and Samaria, as it says, territory. At around the same time, a Reuters piece came out citing, like Axios Anonymous, Israeli security sources that, taken together, sounds like the Israeli government is purposely sending these leaks out as a way to send a message to these countries and to the public without making it official policy and with giving them a way out, plausible deniability if things don't go well. The interesting thing I think about this is that you look at since October 7th happened, okay, go figure, Gaza was going to be the epicenter of all this. We've seen the war expand to Hezbollah in the north. The Houthis are still causing problems. Even militias in places like Iraq have been causing problems. There's, of course, the wars with Iran directly, with the missiles flying over the Middle East in both directions. The West Bank has been strangely quiet. There has definitely been things going on in the West Bank, including attacks on Israel, attacks on the Palestinian Authority, sieges launched against terrorist anarchic communes in the area. But there hasn't been the widespread active warfare like we're seeing in Gaza or some of these other places. And Hamas still has a presence in the West Bank. Hamas definitely has the capability to do Israel harm, but they've been, at the very least, not activating all those resources they have like they could. As soon as France gave that announcement in July and all the other countries jumped on the bandwagon, that basically is now making the West Bank the big nexus for where the international community's attention is, where Israel's attention is. And, I mean, Prime Minister Netanyahu has probably wanted something like annexation for a while, but at this point, all the announcements are forcing his hand a bit, and I even wonder if maybe the Israelis are moving far ahead with that, like, too fast than even they would like to. And again, there's a lot of terror groups in the West Bank. If things move forward, they're not going to be happy with what's going to happen. The Palestinian Authority, they have a very moderate facade, but they still have a lot of weapons. They still have connections to different groups. They're not going to be happy. This could exacerbate tensions there in a way, again, that Israel wasn't even intending. And the reason we're following this is because of a prophecy in Zechariah 14, verses 1 to 2, which says, quote, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, and your spoil will be divided in the midst of you. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city, Jerusalem, will go forth into captivity," etc., etc. Now, you could look at passages like in the book of Revelation that shows Jerusalem, or all nations will battle Christ at Jerusalem at his second coming. That's at the end of the events of the day of the Lord, the events of the end time, all these events that we watch for. But that's listed first here in this order. And you go down, and at the very end, it says half of the city will go forth into captivity. What's all this? Like, with amidst all this chaos, what's all this half of the city about? This is what Mr. Fleury writes in his booklet, Jerusalem Prophecy, quote, "One half of Jerusalem is to be taken captive. Notice how specific this prophecy is. East Jerusalem, one half of the city, will be conquered by the Palestinians." Further down, looking at the ongoing violence in Jerusalem today, the absolute inability of the involved parties to solve things by peaceful means, we can easily see how one half of the of Jerusalem shall be taken captive in the very near future. The present violence is an embryo that is about to explode into much greater violence," end quote. These tensions are going to bubble up into what is essentially the first domino to fall of this chain of reactions, of all these horrible events, all these chaotic events around the world that we're watching. Until this point, nobody really cared about the West Bank. Nobody cared as much about the area bordering Jerusalem. Now that is changing. Increasing tensions around the West Bank, around this area bordering Jerusalem, are important. Even if they don't make front page headline news, even if that's not what everybody else is focused on, this prophetic perspective is why everybody needs to keep their eyes on that.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Well, our other panels haven't left me a huge amount of time to talk about the news from Europe this week, but I'll run down quickly what I can. The EU's trade deal with Mercosur, the Latin American trade bloc, took a big step forward this week. You might remember this deal was signed last year after decades of negotiation. It would be the world's largest free trade deal, but the EU still needs to sign off on it, and they took a major step in that direction this week. A big problem with the deal is that France is dead against it. You know, for France, a core reason that they're in the EU is to protect European farmers, extract concessions for European farmers, perhaps, but they do want to take care of their farmers. I mean, that is kind of something I used to make fun of the French for, but when you look at the way so much of the rest of the world now, we don't take care of our farmers and treat them pretty disdainfully, despite the fact us needing them to live. Maybe they were, you know, they've certainly got something going there that, or something right there, but they don't want their farmers to be put out of business with cheap produce from Latin America. So there are potentially big protests in France about this. Now, the EU is trying to get around the French bloc. What they've done is they've split the Mercosur trade deal now into two, what they're calling pillars. So there's a trade-only pillar, and this requires only a qualified majority of EU nations to support it. It's got that majority now. It's, you know, like, I think, what, two-thirds of nations or most nations representing two-thirds of Europe's population. They keep tweaking the formula, but you get the idea. So it passed that milestone this week. It's got to be signed off on by the European Parliament. Basically, it looks like all the ducks are in a row for that to move forwards now. There's the political and cooperation pillar, though. That requires the unanimous consent of all EU nations. France can block that. That is not moving forwards particularly fast. Now, Hope W. Armstrong had a lot to say about Europe and Latin America working closely together, that this would be an important part of the rising Holy Roman Empire, and Europe's influence over Latin America would be a major part of the power that they have in combating the United States. And so, you know, we're expecting this trade deal to move forwards. But at the same time, Mr. Flurry also pointed out that, well, to complete this controversial deal, the EU will probably have to shift towards the 10-nation autocratic, you know, state led by a strongman that we read about in Bible prophecy and that we're often talking about here. So to fully get this deal over the line, there'll probably have to be a lot of changes. And you can read more about that in our article, Why the World's Largest Trade Deal Will Shake the World. And of course, I also need to keep you updated with the latest on Europe's military revival. Statistics published by the EU shows that EU military spending hit a new record last year. It was up by 19%. That was 343 billion euros, about 400 billion US dollars. They were spending 1.9% of the bloc's GDP. That's a massive increase compared to, say, 10 years ago. The head of the European Defence Agency said it's encouraging to see EU member states taking their defence spending to record levels. Meeting the new NATO target of 3.5% of GDP will require even more effort, spending a total of more than $630 billion a year. So they've got ambitions to grow this even further. And I think you look at what they've already announced and been doing this year, it will grow even further. So keep watching that. And related to this, the German Navy is beefing up its presence in the Baltic Sea. They're hosting some pretty major military exercises there. So Germany has its first foreign military base in Lithuania that's on the Baltic, and it's now demonstrating its capabilities of sustaining its presence there and across this region. So there's military exercises, Quadriga 2025, with 8,000 soldiers, 40 ships, 30 aeroplanes, 1,800 vessels, with 14 different countries participating. Germany's chief of defense said, "We are seeing close up today what it means in concrete terms when Germany takes international responsibility and acts as a reliable supply hub for NATO." And so they're demonstrating these exercises in protecting Lithuania's logistics, protecting food supplies, fuel supplies, critical infrastructure. Again, showing that they can sustain this deployment. And again, Europe's military rise, this is a super important trend to watch. This is on the cover of our latest trumpet print, Germany is arming for World War III. That's what we talked about on our Wednesday show, where we focused on, I sat down with Trumpet Magazine Assistant Managing Editor Philip Nice, and we went through the latest trumpet print and gave you an overview there of all of those different articles. So you can go, you can read our Trumpet Magazine, you could look back on that show to learn more. But thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you to all of our panelists, to George Haddad, Matthew Friesen, and Victor Granados for engineering and production. We'll be back on Wednesday with our regular Trumpet World show. Until then, keep watching your world.